Chapter 2. Ash looks deep inside. Reality is defined through self-reflection. Anonymous, 5 BC. The very idea of manifesting his dream in life invigorated Ash. The pursuit of happiness was de rigueur, yet why had he waited so long to take hold of the reins of life if in the end he was to become a major guru in the field of play that is known as life? Business is daily life. It's like being married or being single or alone. It's that time-consuming. Business is your approach to daily life. It is what you eat, what you think, yet more importantly, it is not what you do in life, but who you are in life. And what you are in life is what ultimately matters, because it matters who you are in spirit and what you believe in life. Just ask yourself these questions. Do you live your life passionately? Are you willing to give it all up to pursue your passion in life in order to live your ideal life? Indira was right yesterday when she questioned my desire to finally be who I want to be. She knows me better than I know myself, Ash mumbled, now walking on the beach at Torrey Pines. The path's long and quiet at this hour of the morning, with just an occasional jogger whistling past you in the opposite direction, the air fresh and smelling of salt water and pines, the green vegetation that can overwhelm you if you pay enough attention. Ash stopped by a rock formation, a hollow spot where once a mighty rock slept. With time, the rock slipped down, leaving an empty space that Ash thought needed to be filled. That empty space is my inner being. The Force is speaking to me. He chuckled like a boy, and with a huge grin on his face, climbed into the cave-like space, taking to the fetal position as if in his mother's belly. The joy this brought him revived his spirits. He thought to take a picture, and so, while waiting for a stranger to pass by, he rocked himself back and forth as if for comfort, feeling calm and protected, happy and warm inside. Yet he did not understand then the impact this experience would later have on him. For there would be future times when life turned for the worst, making him feel a need to return to his mother's womb for comfort and protection. Ash did not even suspect he was on a downward spiral that would last a good long time, but he did believe that by turning the situation around, his life would return to normal. Like most people, he wanted a quick fix, but this was his personal rainy season, the downpour coming down hard from above. He was unable to stop it. This rain would have to take its course. What he needed was the patience and fortitude to make it through, because he knew life does change one day, when you least expect it. The rain does stop, he asserted, and the sunshine returns. Now, when he saw a pretty blonde with a ponytail and sneakers approach from the distance, he boldly called out to her, "Excuse me, ma'am, would you mind taking my picture?" His always present camera during hikes came into use as he enjoyed photographing nature. The young lady said nothing, as if speaking to a stranger would endanger her soft, sheltered life, but taking camera in hand, she proceeded to study it until ready to click. Deed done, she handed the camera back to Ash and took off jogging, something she was not doing when Ash first saw her. Oh well, another scared girl walking through life. It did not occur to him she mirrored the pressing fear palpitating in his soul at the moment. "Thank you," he shouted, though the blonde was now gone. "You take notice of people. Who they are inside, what troubles them, Ash?" Indira once stated after a long dinner in London, when they first started to spend time together. They would order food and sit to eat in mostly silence. They would watch people and make little comments, with Indira noticing the women and Ash seeing everything. "That man must be having problems. Look at his poor face," he would comment. Indira would glance at the man in question and nod her head. "What do you think ails him?" she asked. Ash would look closely at the man sitting a few tables away from them and study his every move, the sighs, the grunts, and the body language. "I think he has a health problem," he stated, seeing Indira's eyes light up. And you know what? Ash was usually right, And so it happened the man in question went to pay at the same time as Ash. And, smiling at each other in a courteous manner, he said something like, "I enjoy the food here." Ash nodded and turned away. The poor man's mouth odor smelled rotten, as if something inside him were dying. The stank was like the smell of a foul cigar, or like a dead dog in a dark alley. He couldn't really place it. Ash couldn't, but he knew this man needed help because one of his uncles in East London had suffered from stomach cancer, and this was the same identical smell. There was no mistaking it. Ash wanted to say something, but what do you say to a stranger in a situation like that? "Excuse me, sir, you're dying of stomach cancer, but don't know it. And if you do, I am sorry to have caused you embarrassment. Go see your doctor at once." Ash wanted to vomit from the memory of his uncle's putrid breath, a memory that now would not leave his nostrils. After paying the bill, he returned to Indira, who was at the table waiting so quietly, hands folded like a schoolgirl, and told her the story. "You see, Ash, you have powers that need to be developed." Although Ash shook his head in agreement, she left it at that. It was up to him to create his own destiny. And if he did not take her comment seriously enough to develop a stronger sense of the self, so be it. Ash felt something like a worm run down his back, giving him the chills, leaving him puzzled at the thought of self-actualization, because he didn't know how to begin the process. Now, though, with the walk through the pines, the sand, the wind and surf healing him back to the old Ash from those London days, a guy so straight and committed others envied him, he began to plan his move into the world of spiritual awakenings. He had books. Many books to reread and essays to write that, even if they were never published, would guide him in the direction he needed to go. The world was awakening. Masses of individuals were seeking the light, looking for answers, asking the interminable questions to self-understanding. A new age of thought, a journey to enlightenment. Success and corruption, decadence and ego were destroying many a human being like never before. There was so much money in the world, it drove people to betray themselves and their every fiber of integrity by stealing and deceptive business practices. According to Ash, the world was an oyster to be slurped and devoured, though in a proper manner. Yet, unhappiness ruled his day. Ash remembered a story a good friend told him a few years back when his new country was at war with some Eastern Bloc Islamic entity that pissed off every right-winger in sight. The story went like this. A friend from New York City was quite unhappy for many years after making tons of money as a Wall Street thief, taking life savings from the elderly, raising a family, and living an enviable materialistic life that led nowhere. Or rather, a life he saw one day as a dead end. So he decided to change his life and thought, hey, why not buy a huge house out on Long Island, maybe the Hamptons, socialize more, and maybe enjoy life for a change. Find happiness. So he does, but soon discovers that more of the same doesn't solve a thing. Wanting real change, he gathered his family and moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico, where it is common to find filthy rich, aimless people in search of themselves. If you've ever lived in Santa Fe, you know that you can find the rich, the famous, the dropouts, the ex-wives clubs, and many discontented souls in search of spiritual answers to life, and numerous others looking to see their life work. In other words, aimless inheritors of the new American religion, money. Well, this very rich man and his family moved to Santa Fe to start an exciting new life with its East Coast refugees, Ponzi scheme con men, and lost souls that make the place a haven for runaways. Anyway, just as expected, the rich guy joins clubs, health and reading, intellectual and social, all to no avail because unknowingly, he was simply replicating his past, though in an altogether different place. Within months, he saw his life as empty and meaningless, saw himself as unable to find the elusive happiness he so desired. His gloom covered him like a wet blanket, A month after his son went off to college, he discovered his wife was having an affair with a young pianist from Budapest. But being numb to life, he ignored it, seduced a girl of his own, only to find he was bored to tears with her constant desire to turn everyday issues into drama. Remembering a fluorescent green flyer he saw one morning at the local coffee shop announcing self-healing, he got into his fire engine red, newly restored 55 Chevy truck, drove to the coffee shop, ripped the flyer from the announcement board as if he owned it, and sped off to the studio where a gathering of souls seeking enlightenment was taking place. A Tibetan monk, with shaved head and wrapped in a bright orange tunic, was giving a talk on Buddhism, happiness, and the shining light within. The rich man had to laugh at the thought of being in this crowd, and he did so out loud, causing everyone to turn to him in scorn. The monk did not respond to his laughter, nor did he chastise, correct, or discipline the gesture. Instead, he continued speaking, now with more passion. At the evening's end, the rich man saw an attractive woman on the way out. And thinking of making a new friend in town, he approached her. But she spoke before he could utter a word. "You are quite the unhappy man, aren't you?" The rich man looked puzzled. "I only ask because it was rude to laugh at His Highness." The rich man retorted, "What are you doing here, dear madam, if you are so happy yourself?" "Touché," she replied, as the Tibetan monk appeared out of nowhere. To say the least, a great silence took over. One could hear his heartbeat as the monk shook the rich man's hand. The rich man did not know how to respond to this handshake. The monk stood silent, looking into the unhappy man's eyes. His disciples gathered around to hear the words of enlightenment. All eyes were now on the rich man, waiting to hear him speak again, or to apologize to the monk for laughing. "I have been unhappy my whole life," he confessed without as much as a frown. "I have all the riches in the world, a good family and success, yet happiness still eludes me." The monk smiled and considered, "I want you to take a month from your life and direct a project for me. You see, we have 1,000 wheelchairs to donate to children in Croatia, children who lost limbs in war, the lame and the paralyzed. We need someone to hand them out. That someone is you." The rich man looked at the monk and everyone around him. Every person in the room was looking for answers to happiness and the light within. His disciples listened intently as if the monk's every word would instantly change their life. Another silence took over as the rich man accepted with a simple nod of the head. The next day, the rich man arranged shipment and gladly paid for it. A huge check from one of his 100 investments had arrived in the mail the day before, so he used a chunk of it for the trip. He packed his bags and called a car service to take him to the airport, where he boarded a last-minute chartered flight to the war-ravaged country. He was still unhappy. Happiness was still elusive. But the project would burn some time from his redundant, uninteresting life. He had nothing better to do, after all. In Croatia, he donated wheelchairs, going from one village to another until the month was nearly over. In the last village visited before the return flight home, he gave a wheelchair to a boy with one arm and both legs amputated, an eye patch, his hair shaved, not unlike that of the Tibetan monk. As the rich man had accustomed himself to lifting the young amputees into their new wheelchair homes, he did the same with this young boy. But something different happened with this lift. The boy took the rich man's left wrist and clenched it with the strength of a lion. The rich man did not know what to do, and nervous with anticipation, he looked in the direction of his translator, a young woman who spoke enough English to explain it all. "What does he want?" asked the rich man, panic in his speech. "The boy wants to look in your eyes," he says. "Your eyes are to the ground." It was in that moment, and with those words, that the rich man saw just who he was inside. A coward. As he could not lift his eyes to look at the boy. "Why does he want to look into my eyes?" he asked, still with his head down. The interpreter bent down to speak to him as he was kneeling in shame. The boy says he wants to look into your eyes so he can remember your face and thank you when he gets to heaven. The rich man went home to Santa Fe and rushed to see the monk straight from the airport. "Thank you, my friend," he said. "Thank you for sending me on this project." The monk heard joy in his voice and saw stars in his eyes. He smiled. "Tell me, what happened?" he asked, already knowing the ending. The rich man told the story of the young boy, adding, "That was the first time in my life I was happy." The rich man was permitted to stay as a disciple. Ash smiled in memory of his good friend and fellow engineer Dave Jock, who told him this story. It was a strong telling by Dave, who also spoke in a quiet voice, knowing the ending was catchy. The engineer knew very well the meaning of purpose in life and the importance of one's life being of use to others. In the end, he said, the story was more about one's life changing in a flash. Now Ash was on to something, because as he thought more and more about becoming a guru businessman, every spiritual teaching absorbed would now serve him in life. The memorized sutras would be part of his teachings. He would compose a series of questions for his future disciples, for that is what followers would be. He would put together a seminar teaching others to abandon the suffering we accumulate along the path of life, using this job loss as an example. Many in America were losing jobs and homes, some their own minds in this difficult world. A guru of Indian descent was more likely to be listened to than, say, the ways of black magic. "We of India are seen as wise men, sages," he asserted, now returning to his gleaming silver Mercedes-Benz parked with a ticket on the front windshield. "We have a spiritual inheritance awaiting us as people from India." His self-confidence now in place, the job mishap forgotten, Ash took the parking ticket in hand and stuffed it in his coat pocket. "I forgot to put money in the meter," he thought, laughing because he knew he had just entered a world where earthly matters such as the parking ticket were of little importance. The undertaking was rough. Ash had to figure out how to launch his business venture, who to call, who to contact, how to define himself, what to say. Could he simply start a seminar telling people he was a failure and the inherent reasons in that? Is that the way to go? Yes, he thought, to conventional people, this is not the way to start, because the conservative mind does not have the space to think outside of what it knows. The conventional mind hears something, like a friend who is a writer and thinks, "Man, this guy is going to punch walls. He's a writer." The conservative mind thinks every writer punches walls or destroys things. This is essentially stupid, and we all know it. But an enlightened mind thinks, "Oh, he is a writer. I wonder what he has to say." Similarly, Ash believed he could step onto the stage and say these first words. "Hello, my name is Ash, and I have been a failure. Now, I am not." Of course he could start the seminar this way, he reasoned, because the group gathered had to see him as a fully formed human being. A human being with flaws, a man with dents in his armor, if you will. The faster you admit to your faults, the smoother the road you take in your journey to enlightenment. Yes, it is not easy to look at yourself in the mirror. In fact, few people are willing to do so. Yet, in starting the seminar with these words, your audience sits straight up in their chair and looks in the mirror. After all, that is the reason they are here in the first place. They want to change. Who doesn't? Ash was happy to discover his first strategy. How would he get butts in the chairs? What did he need to do to get started? The questions kept coming. And although he had a strategy and a basic theme to delve into, what would be his modus operandi? Indira suggested he attend the weekend seminar taking place at the local Lutheran church, a 2-day look at Christ on the cross. The pastor wanted to explain Lutherans do not believe in the crucifixion as a bloody sacrifice, but as God sacrificing his son to cleanse us of our sins. The Catholic Church instead portrays Christ on the cross as an object of pity, his forehead bloody from a thorny crown, a punctured rib, his head down, robust nails hammered into his feet and hands. The crucifixion to Lutherans was a giving of the self for Jesus, plain and simple. And though Indira knew well the subject of Christianity and that the crucifixion had nothing to do with her husband's future seminar, she did believe the pastor would present a detailed way to conduct a seminar. "Watch what he does. Study his strategy." "I knew I married you for a reason, Indira." The two laughed, diffusing tension, a force that was slowly leaving their space, allowing all Jeffrey family members to return to normal. Soon Ash would be playful again, Indira at ease, without as much as a care in the world, the two daughters giggling over boys in their room, the house blissful. "I am not a Christian, but I wish to learn from this experience," said Ash, when asked to identify and tell something about himself, as is often customarily done at seminars. People get to know a little bit about each other, if only to learn something important they can take away at course's end. A CEO may be hiring, a business leader wants to sell his shop, people are surviving cancer, things like that. The participants get to chat about those things during breaks, and sometimes friendships develop as a result of just what it is you say in front of others. Ash noticed everyone in the room was looking for something, if only a change in life. One woman stood up and said, "I want to change the world, but have no idea where to start." This got a big laugh. Ash too wanted to change the world, but his objective was to have 10 times this many people sitting in chairs before him at his seminars. Maybe 300 souls at once, all looking for the answer to the riddle of life. Still, that little voice inside told him he wasn't worth a shit. "You know, Indira, everything I learned about multi-level marketing means nothing at the moment. You would think I could apply it here, but no." Ash had spent several years with his good friend Chris Crandall running their joint business, Electric Juice, making money hand over fist with what they thought was just a stupid merchandise name, though with a superior product. Any type of vegetable or fruit juice you wanted at a fair price. The fruit came from everywhere in the world, from guanabana to papaya, kiwi, green apples, strawberries and raspberries, all from New Zealand, mangoes, tamarinds, and red cherries from Mexico, the lot. Customers would line the street and fill the sidewalk for a taste of the new health drink in town. New locations were opened, employees hired, taxes paid. Why, Ash even bought old mom and dad a week's vacation back to Delhi to see family from 1,000 years ago. Times were good. Ash was just meeting Indira, and no big plans were in store for his future life, other than to keep the bus rolling in a successful direction. Most of the money he made in the enterprise was spent on the move to the United States, buying furniture and securing a first automobile. Now, though, nothing from that work experience seemed to help Ash to get on his feet with his seminar, an undertaking yet unnamed. The name mattered, he knew it, but nothing came to mind. He wasted valuable time attempting to resolve meaningless issues ahead of time, like the space to be used, when instead he should have been out there shaking hands, going to coffee shops to meet new people. He read the encyclopedia at home to find a name or a keyword for his new venture. One day, Devanchi, his firstborn daughter, was doing homework, writing with a high concentration that seemed to burn the very paper she was scribbling on. Ash walked by her room on the way from the library. "What are you writing, dear?" he asked. "I'm composing an essay for English class titled Taming the Lion," she answered innocently. And kaboom, Ash had a title and concept for the seminar just like that, because taming the lion is what he'd been doing his entire adult life. The expression defined his life, his every fiber of being, because that little something that ate at his insides was indeed the lion. And not the alligator or bear of his imagination. It was a lion, indeed. The bloody cat roared inside him, kept him immobile, paralyzed, leaving Ash with no choice but to want to run and hide or scream at the top of his voice. It was the lion in him Ash needed to tame. Knowing his daughter gifted him in a royal way, he kissed her on the forehead and rushed to Indira's side. Indira, his support, his intuition, his inspiration, and now his muse. "Now I have it," he shifted about in a little dance. "What do you have, dear?" she asked, looking up from her book. "The title of the seminar. See, we are all looking to solve things. We are looking for answers, seeking the light, wanting to have an expression that defines our purpose in life. And I found it, because something is bothering us deep inside, disturbing our daily life, and eating away at us slowly like a parasite devouring your gut." Now he really danced. Taking Indira's hand to lift her from the couch, he circled her about, spinning her, she flowing in her green sari, sandals scraping the floor, amused yet again by her husband whose emotional life twisted and turned in an unexpected way. "The title of my seminar will be Taming the Lion. You see? Taming the beast inside." "You get high and then low, Ash. Is this really the title of your seminar?" "Yes, we will be taming the lion." His daughter Da Vinci, now listening by the door, smirked at her father. Indira stared at him as Ash raised his arms in the air to praise the Lord the very way Christian evangelicals do at Sunday service, so to be noticed. "I will be taming the lion," he repeated. "Yes," Indira pointed out. "But first, you must tame the lion within."